You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including the arrest of a local nurse for drug theft, conflict on the Upper Rogue River, and funding for the Josephine County 4-H Extension Service District. I'm Eric Newman, news director.
I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
I'm Jane Vaughn. I'm the housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
Justin, we're going to start with you. You reported on a big development this week in a criminal justice, in a criminal case of drug diversion at Asante Rogue Regional Medical Center. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Medford police arrested former Asante nurse Dani Marie Schofield yesterday. And that arrest came after a grand jury indicted her on 44 counts of assault in the second degree this week. Each of those counts represent a patient in her care that authorities claim she intentionally harmed. And we've been following this case pretty closely since the beginning of this year. Like a lot of people in the region, it's gotten a lot of press. And so just for some background, we got news that an unknown number of patients had gotten infections, may have even died while at Asante after their liquid fentanyl was replaced with tap water in their IV. Patients and families of patients that may have been affected by this were contacted by Asante late last year about that. And before that, Asante had been public about having a spike in central line-associated bloodstream infections within the last 2 years. That happens when there's some contamination while using a catheter, like with an IV. And the hospital is required to report that to the OHA, so those numbers are public information. According to some reports, that swapping of drugs with tap water was the reason for those infections. Tap water isn't sterile. It's okay to drink, but really anyone in healthcare would know that it's very dangerous to just inject tap water into a patient's bloodstream. And Medford police yesterday confirmed that that's what they think happened. They allege Schofield was stealing fentanyl and replacing it with tap water. And that made dozens of patients really, really sick.
Okay, so she was indicted on 44 counts of assault in the second degree. Is there anything that stands out about these charges?
Yeah, a couple things. One, the decision by authorities to not charge Schofield with anything related to possible deaths from these infections, like manslaughter or homicide. She's just being charged with assault, basically causing these infections in patients. At a press conference yesterday, the Medford police chief confirmed that 16 out of those 44 patients they investigated that Schofield allegedly stole drugs from, they died. So 16 out of those 44 died. But the reason authorities gave for not charging Schofield for those deaths was because they couldn't prove that those deaths were directly caused by the infection Schofield allegedly caused. Although there's one civil case against Schofield and the hospital from the estate of an alleged victim who died at Asante, that was filed in February. And there's another law firm in Medford that say they're looking at a number of potential wrongful death suits related to this case. So on the civil side, at least, these lawyers think they can prove that Schofield's actions directly caused patients' deaths. Another thing that jumped out to me is the time frame that police say they looked at. They narrowed their investigation to infections that occurred between July of 2022 and July of 2023, so exactly a year. But that wrongful death case I mentioned is for a patient that died in February of 2022. So that case isn't counted in this investigation. And I'm not sure at this point why authorities narrowed down their investigation to that time frame. So it seems at least possible that patients outside of that year could have also been involved.
Okay. So police have been very quiet about this over the course of the investigation until this press conference that you mentioned yesterday. What's next in this case, and what's next for Schofield that you know of?
So Medford police say that this is the end of their investigation. It took them 7 months, and they say they interviewed dozens of people, went through hundreds of pages of medical documents. In the coming months, we'll probably learn more about Dani Marie Schofield, who she is. Right now, we know very little, just that she's 36, she worked as a nurse for years, and she left Asante around the time of these allegations. She's facing an arraignment today, and that begins the criminal trial process. The deputy district attorney for Jackson County mentioned that for assault in the second degree in Oregon, Schofield faces a minimum mandatory sentencing of 70 months for each of those 44 counts of assault. So that's effectively a life sentence she faces.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. We'll keep following this one. Roman, we're going to turn to you. You brought us a story this week about a conflict on the Upper Rogue River, which is around a 30-mile stretch north of Medford. In recent years, there's been debate about the use of jet boats on this part of the river. First, can you tell us a little bit about what this conflict involves?
Yeah, there's a few sides to the argument here. That includes people who want to ban or restrict these tour boats because of their damage to the environment. There's others like landowners or anglers who are concerned about the safety and noise from these boats. And then there's also people who just think the claims are unwarranted and see the benefits of having these jet boats in the river.
Okay, so just to back up, for those who don't know, what are jet boats?
So if you're thinking of like a jet engine strapped onto the end of a boat, that's not what it's like. That's what I originally thought of too. Basically, instead of an outboard propeller that sits underneath the water and spins to move it forward, you have a pump that's inside the boat that draws the water in and it shoots it out the back of the boat. There's a couple benefits to this. One, they can maneuver very quickly and easily, and they can turn really sharply and stop quickly. They can also operate in shallower water than boats with external propellers because there's nothing sticking out from the bottom. These modern boats were developed in the 1950s in New Zealand because there's a lot of shallow, fast-moving rivers there, and they've since become a really popular commercial boat used for tours like they are here. There's a few companies that take people on jet boat tours in different parts of the Rogue River, including the Upper Rogue River and the Hellgate Recreation Area. And because they go so fast, they're pretty popular for tourists that, you know, love to shred some waves.
Ah, yes. As we all do. So thanks for that background. So why are these different groups concerned about the use of jet boats specifically in this section of the river?
Yeah, there's a couple of groups with concerns here, including environmental groups and homeowners. The environmental groups are concerned about the impacts of these jet boats on salmon populations and erosion of the riverbed. There aren't any specific studies on this section of the Rogue River, but one study looking at the impacts of jet boats on Alaska streams showed that they can harm salmon eggs on the riverbed, especially in shallow streams. But the time period when these jet boats are most active, which is during the summer, is outside the typical salmon spawning season in the fall. Homeowners along the riverfront are also concerned about the noise level of these boats. They're kind of loud and they run around 3 to 5 times every day. Other community members, including anglers and floaters, are concerned about their safety because these boats go really fast. I talked to Francis O. Young, who's a program manager for Rogue Riverkeeper, and they said one of their main concerns too is the use of the Tuvel State Recreation Site to launch these jet boats, which is near Table Rock. They claim that the state should be requiring the jet boat company to have a special permit to use the park for their tours. But according to Oregon Parks and Rec, they say that's not the case. As long as they follow the rules, everyone else has to follow, which seems like that's what they're doing right now.
Okay. So you also spoke to the owner of one of the major jet boat tour companies operating in this part of the river. What did they have to say about it?
Yeah. So I talked to Taylor Grimes, who's the owner of Rogue Jet Boat Adventures. They've been running for about 13 years. He said part of the problem is that people just don't understand jet boats and their impacts as much as they should. He says that jet boats are less impactful on salmon populations than regular boats because the thrust that they generate happens at the top of the water line and not underneath the water like with these propellers. I tried to find out more about, you know, this. I looked at an environmental impact statement from the Bureau of Land Management back in 2003 about the management of the Hellgate Recreation Area, which is further downriver from the Rogue River from here. So in that management plan, they specifically banned jet boats between October and April during the salmon spawning season with the potential to close down jet boats a little bit earlier if they see salmon spawning earlier. They also mentioned that erosion of the riverbanks is primarily caused by heavy winter water flows and not from jet boat usage. Another benefit mentioned was that jet boats bring in a lot of people to the river that normally wouldn't be visiting the river. These tours often include information about local history and the environment, so kind of help people learn about the river when they might not get to have a chance normally.
Okay. And so part of this debate is that there are public agencies gathering comment about this issue right now. It sounds like people have a few opportunities to take part in community meetings about this, one on Monday night. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so four state agencies have been holding these community info gathering sessions over the past month with this organization called Oregon's Kitchen Table. It's partly because they're trying to decide. There's a bunch of agencies that have different rules, like Oregon State Parks and Rec manages the Tuvalu State Recreation Site, but the Marine Board manages the river itself, so they all have to kind of figure out how they would implement regulations if they do. There's one last one scheduled for 5:30 p.m. at the Medford Library on Monday night. So they're going to be gathering thoughts and views on recreational uses of the Upper Rogue River, and then they'll take from what they've gathered from those sessions and from an online survey that ends on July 5th, and they'll release a report about the results. So we'll expect a report around the end of July, early August. And from there, state agencies will decide what they want to do, you know, if they want to consider new regulations or not.
Okay, thanks, Roman. Jane, we're going to turn to you now. You covered a story this week about the 4-H Extension Service District in Josephine County. Very benign sounding organization. So first off, what is the 4-H Extension Service District?
So that's a tax district that was established by the voters back in 1996, and it provides programs in youth development, agriculture. A lot of people are familiar with their Master Gardener program, community health. They have a lot of different programs. They're run by OSU, and the tax rate for that district is about 4.5 cents per $1,000 of assessed property value. So if you've got a house that's about $500,000 being valued, then it's about $23 in taxes per year that then go to this extension service.
Okay. So what happened this week related to the extension? Why are we talking about this tax district?
So the budget committee in Josephine County voted on Tuesday to approve funding for the extension. It was not unanimous. It was 3-2. And the reason that's so interesting is that the Board of Commissioners defunded the extension last year. So there was a controversy over displays of religious symbols in 4-H programs, which are, as I said, managed by OSU. So they need to have religious neutrality. Okay. So they were defunded last year. The extension has been running on reserves for the past year. And so they say they really need that funding this year.
Okay. So what were some of the arguments being made on Tuesday?
So as I said, it was 3-2, not unanimous. Commissioners John West and Herman Bertschiger voted against funding 4-H. They say that voters meant for this money to be used for youth livestock education, not for all these other programs and administration. Herman Bertschiger was also concerned about not having a breakdown for how each individual program is funded. He said the budget was incomplete. OSU Extension says they just view the extension as one program. They don't budget it out by individual programs, so they don't have that information. Commissioner Dan DeYoung and the budget committee members Diane Hoover and Larry West were in favor of the proposed budget. Dan DeYoung was pointing out that the livestock program is only one small part of what the extension does. They do all these other programs as well. Home economics, youth, agriculture, forestry, it's not just livestock. And I will say that everyone who spoke during public comment at Tuesday's meeting, that was over a dozen people, they were all in favor of funding 4-H as well and spoke really highly of their programs.
Okay, so the program was funded this week, but there's not certainty that
right.
the funding might continue. So what happens next?
Yeah, it's kind of confusing. So the Josephine County Budget Committee approved the funding this week, but it still has to go to the Board of Commissioners. And as I said, two of the three commissioners opposed funding it on Tuesday. So they could still defund it. It's unclear what that would mean if the Board of Commissioners defunds the extension. I don't know if they'll have the money to be able to continue operating, if they'll have the reserves. So the county is going to hold a public hearing for its budget on June 26th, and the final budget adoption will occur on June 28th. So we'll have to see what happens then.
Okay. Thanks, Jane.
Thanks.
Justin, we're going to pivot back to you. You also reported on another proposed update to the Josephine County Charter this week. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Josephine County resident Jonathan Knapp, he's trying to get a measure changing the county's charter on the ballot. He's trying to collect over 4,000 signatures to bring that change to voters this November. And this comes after a different measure to change the charter failed in May. That proposal that failed, that would have increased the number of commissioners, reduced their pay, created districts for candidates, and created this new position of county manager. It would have also required all elected offices be nonpartisan.
Okay. So can you just give us a brief description about what this new charter change would include?
Yeah. So it's very different, and Knapp opposed that measure, which failed. So one thing his measure would do is make elected positions partisan. Josephine, it's historically leaned right, but non-affiliated voters are the largest voting bloc there. And under Oregon law, making offices partisan would mean unaffiliated voters couldn't participate in primary elections for, say, Republican or Democratic candidates. And then there's a sort of laundry list of other things the measure would do. It would require commissioner candidates to have lived in the county for at least 2 years, ban officials from holding more than one elected office. It would also prohibit a county sales tax, ranked choice voting, and also prohibit vaccine requirements for employment or education.
Okay, great. Well, that is a lot of different things on that charter change. So we don't yet know if that will make it to the November ballot, but Knapp, who you mentioned, says he's confident he can get the signatures to do it. So we will revisit that, I'm sure. That is going to do it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments about our coverage and suggestions for things that we should cover in the future through our news tip line. You can find that on our website at ijpr.org. You can find this program and more on our website at jeffexchange.org, or you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms.